this edition of Radio EcoShock.
It's June 8th, 2015.
One carton of milk is $12.99.
Gas has reached over $9 a gallon.
I'm scared right now, but I have to get this out.
So basically all of those things put together mean that there isn't really much of a future for an economy in the United States of the size that exists today. It's going to be much smaller. Now, a smaller economy cannot maintain and service a huge debt. So that means bankruptcy.
Now, that result is a product of the junk science that's been funded by the oil industry to make people think that 2 and 2 might be 5 under some circumstances. Who knows? We can't really tell. Leading to the extraordinary delay.
Well, I have been actively promoting climate change and global warming to the animal rights movement since I am deeply rooted in that movement.
The smart money led by Warren Buffett is now heading for the exit, spooked by steeply rising nuclear costs, disappointments in the flagship Finnish project, competition by ever-cheaper micropower megawatts, and the credit crunch. The U.S. can have only about as many new nuclear plants as taxpayers are forced to buy.
ABC News discovers global warming and invites you to game it. Our feature guest Dmitry Orlov asks what the Soviet fall can tell us about the developing collapse of the American empire. A brief clip from the Minneapolis Conference for Media Reform, and we'll tell you where to get much more. Then Anthony Marr goes global warming. Will other animal rights activists join him? And you'll hear Amory Lovins tell Congress why more nuclear power is no solution at all. Toss in a few record floods, more drought, and more fire, and there's another hour of Crisis Radio.
I talked to 3 people, casual conversation today, all of them smart, saying, I don't know, we must be doing something to our Earth. So once and for all, what's going on here?
Well, there are some correlations that can be made. Global warming, not quite one of them.
At this pace, we could expect to see over 1,800 tornadoes reported by the end of the year.
Nothing like this has ever happened here.
It was insane.
Record flooding is forecast this week along hundreds of miles of the Mississippi to crest on Thursday at a record 30.
Global warming, not quite. Global warming, not quite.
This is a national exercise.
I'm your host in the whirlwind, Alex Smith.
Flinging bent cutlery back at the crooked dinner lady of our entertainment industry.
Everyone in the West has dug his head into the sand like ostriches. No one wants to admit these problems exist.
Is America headed towards bankruptcy, the collapse of a worldwide empire? How would you survive if gas or oil get way too expensive or sometimes not available at all? Maybe we could learn something from the fallen Soviet Union, where people had to remake a new society. Today we are joined by a former Russian who witnessed the Soviet collapse. He is an engineer who has worked on high-energy physics and things like internet security. Now Dmitry Orlov has written a really useful book about civilizations in trouble. Welcome, Dmitry.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
Well, of course, we're going to talk about your new book, Reinventing Collapse, The Soviet Example and American Prospects. But first, I'd like to plunge right into something else you've written with your advice for the next American government. I mean, we're $9 trillion in debt the day the new president takes office, at least. We heard some unreal promises from Obama and McCain. Can you tell us about your collapse party platform?
Well, it's basically a mock political party because no government ever actually explicitly prepares for collapse. They do everything they can to avert or postpone it, and sometimes those efforts bring the collapse closer than instead of helping defer it. But I identified a few things that I thought would be worth doing, just basically in an effort to prevent disasters that are avoidable. One of those, for instance, is not letting troops, American troops, which are scattered all over the globe, become stranded overseas, sometimes in hostile lands, sometimes in indifferent lands, and not letting their weapons fall into the wrong hands. The United States maintains over 1,000 military bases around the world. A lot of them don't actually serve much of a purpose. and they require a functioning civilian economy in order to resupply those bases. They're not self-sufficient. They use copious amounts of fossil fuels, basically oil-derived things like gasoline and diesel. And that is really not something that this country will be able to keep going after the economy shuts down. So I would think that repatriating those soldiers as soon as possible, shutting down and cleaning up the bases, bringing all this war material back into the United States or destroying it, these are all excellent ideas. Another thing that I would like to see done is secure all the nuclear fuel and nuclear installations. After the fall of the Soviet Union, by a happy accident more than anything else, none of the fissile material fell into the hands of terrorists, and there were no Chernobyl-like disasters. There were some reports of radiation leak, but nothing to rival Chernobyl. I really don't want to see fissile material falling into the wrong hands, and also I don't want to see nuclear power plants become abandoned if there is no way to maintain them. So they should be shut down, and the nuclear fuel that's stored at those locations should be transferred to someplace safer. Another thing I would like to see done is a gradual whittling down of the prison population instead of a chaotic general amnesty when the resources to maintain that prison population run out. Luckily, that is already starting to happen because various states, even prosperous ones like Connecticut, are paroling nonviolent offenders. A lot of them are there because of drug charges, because of draconian drug laws. And they're paroling them ahead of time because they're running out of money. So that's really a good trend. And lastly, the last thing I would like to see happen is there are a lot of unrepayable debts that are still carried on the books, being treated as repayable, and it's just a waste of effort. And I think that a general jubilee, a forgiveness of all of these unrepayable debts, a giant reset would be very therapeutic and helpful and wipe the slate clean. And if we do it while there is still some scope for government action, because the government isn't shut down due to lack of resources, you know, that would that might help people prepare, you know, bring in some element of reality into people's lives. So those are basically the things that I half jokingly thought would be worth doing, because I don't expect them to be done.
Well, you sound really sane to me. You've got my vote. Even if the economy somehow stumbles along, most of those things need to be done so that we could retool into a really sustainable life with a really productive economy again. Now, I don't want to belabor this point, but you've talked about collapse. Can you fairly briefly try and say why you think the situation in America is so serious?
Well, if you look at energy specifically, it's really clear what is about to happen, what is unfolding as we speak, really. The United States imports over two-thirds of petroleum and petroleum products at this point. It's the single biggest contribution to the trade deficit. It's beginning to dwarf the trade imbalance with China, for instance. It probably will after the price of oil doubles a few more times. And that is not really a sustainable scenario, because what's happening now is that Americans are printing more and more money with which to buy oil, but the nations that sell oil don't really want any more dollars, because it's not really a very trustworthy currency at this point. It keeps depreciating. So they'll be holding back their reserves. Another effect that's happening is exporting nations, which most of them are post-peak and are basically looking to conserve their patrimony in terms of their oil endowment. They don't really want to squander it. If in a situation where you can cut down your oil exports, say by a factor of two, and the price of oil as a response to that will go up by a factor of two, then it's a wash, but you have more oil left. So they would probably try to squelch their oil exports as opposed to boost them, which is not good news for the U.S. And lastly, they're so flush with revenue from their oil exports that as they invest this revenue in their own economy, their economies grow and consume more energy, meaning that there is less oil available for export. So all of those things combined mean that the U.S. is going to be maybe gradually, maybe suddenly, but cut off from two-thirds of all the oil that's required to run this economy. Now, the thing to keep in mind is that it's really all built around oil. There's very little that can happen economically in the United States that does not require oil. And if we, say, wanted to build something that doesn't run on oil, right, that runs on solar or hydro or you know, horse manure or what have you, you have to go and take out a loan. Now, what's going to be the collateral for that loan? Well, it's going to be things that run on oil, right? Jet aircraft, heavy equipment, what have you. And as you're constructing that thing, you're going to be using oil. So it's not likely that all of that equipment that burns oil is going to be very valuable as collateral if oil is in short supply. So you won't get that loan. So basically all of those things put together mean that there isn't really much of a future for an economy in the United States of the size that exists today. It's going to be much smaller. Now, a smaller economy cannot maintain and service a huge debt. So that means bankruptcy.
We're talking with Dmitry Orlov. His new book is Reinventing Collapse, The Soviet Example and American Prospects. It's just out from New Society Publishers. Well, you know, when I'm thinking about what happened in the Soviet Union, I've got this sort of fuzzy picture like, well, we won or something, and then maybe the mafia had a role, and it's all very mixed up with Yeltsin in there drinking heavily, perhaps. We really don't know anything about it. What could you tell us about what happened in the Soviet Union and how that might apply to future events right here in North America?
Well, a lot of things went wrong in the Soviet Union. You know, too many to count. But what really made the whole proposition of maintaining the empire untenable was, again, energy. Russian oil production peaked a few years, about 3 years, something like that, before the Soviet Union collapsed. Oil was what allowed Russia to earn foreign currency with which to buy grain on the world market from the United States, from Canada. And the Soviet Union became complacent during the years when they were flush with oil production and oil prices were high. They were very high in the 70s, relatively. And so they became complacent, and they got used to this way of behaving where they thought they could continue to buy whatever they needed from the West. Now, what happened after their production peaked is it coincided with the North Sea in Norway and the UK and Prudhoe Bay in Alaska coming on stream. And suddenly there was a miraculous economy, recovery of the economies of the West, which was wrongly attributed to Thatcherite and Reaganite politics that really just had to do with the fact that oil was suddenly cheap again. But what that meant for the Soviet Union is they suddenly saw their revenues plummet, but they became so dependent on these imports that they had to borrow money in order to continue receiving them. And the Soviet Union at the very end started taking on foreign debt at a rate that could not be sustained. And that put it pretty much at the mercy of foreign creditors. You know, it made Soviet foreign policy basically a dead letter. You know, so the collapse of the Berlin Wall from that point on was just basically, you know, creditors demanding their pound of flesh.
Well, that could certainly happen in America. We're seeing some of the oil-rich governments buying into American banks, buying into American real estate. Pretty soon they may be able to call some tunes, do you think?
I think they're already doing it to a fair extent. It used to be that the U.S. government thought that, you know, some foreign government took their reserves, you know, treasury paper, and sold it and tried to buy their way into the American economy, basically snapping up private equity. That would be considered almost like an act of war. That policy went by the wayside some time ago, you know, which is a sign of desperation. And now we have sovereign wealth funds buying up big chunks of banks. Whenever a bailout is required, they're basically invited to the table. And what that really is a surrender of sovereignty. So that, for instance, the Saudis will be able to rent or buy outright big chunks of the Midwest and grow food there and export it, even if there is malnutrition and starvation in the United States. And the people in this country won't be able to do very much about it. Yes, this country is being surrendered piece by piece to foreign creditors.
Another example I could take from Soviet history seems serious to me. Just take a second here. Back in 1932, when the main cities, particularly Moscow, ran out of food for the citizens, the troops were sent out into the country to grab anything they could find from the farmers, even the seeds for next year's planting. I think that could happen again. I mean, no government, even in nice countries like Canada or Britain, supposedly, is going to let masses of people in the big cities get too hungry. So the powers that be to feed the cities will go out and get whatever they need. And I wonder, you know, our food's coming from the other side of the world right now. The whole city system seems a bit unstable to me. Would you agree with that premise?
Well, there are things that can be done in many cities. It depends. For instance, you know, Las Vegas or Phoenix, Arizona, nothing will ever grow there. They don't have water. They have plenty of sunshine, but no water. But there are various other places which basically can reform themselves Havana style. For instance, instead of importing vegetables into the city, you can import dirt. And you only have to import the dirt once. And then people convert parking lots into raised bed agriculture by nailing together boxes. And they convert highways, because there's no traffic anymore, because there's no oil, into water catchment systems for irrigation. You know, they grow chickens and rabbits and guinea pigs and whatever else you can, you know, on their rooftops and balconies, and they can stay fed that way. It's a different approach, but it's viable, and it's actually more viable than a rural population that isn't really used to being self-sufficient. They usually grow one or two cash crops, but then they go shopping to the supermarket, which can be quite a distance away and requires them to drive. So once that lifestyle is no longer available to them, the rural scene is much more difficult to make sustainable in some ways than the city scene, where a concerted effort can be made and the people are right there to do it.
Well, this is one of the things I like about your work. It isn't just a negative put down at all. You do offer a lot of really useful ideas about rethinking and reorganizing our lives. In a way, we might all come out better in the long run. In fact, you say young people could thrive after the crash. How could that be?
Well, there are a lot of things that are quite ridiculous. You know, having gone through this educational system for a while, you know, there is a certain ridiculous aspect to, you know, the success scenario as it's being touted. You know, basically going through lots and lots of courses, cramming for tests and learning lots of things that you then quickly forget, because it's really all a test of short-term memory. You know, because that's how the educational system is really structured. I find that is fairly ridiculous. I think saddling yourself with educational debt, as a lot of students in the U.S. have to do, and then being forced to take on some soulless corporate job instead of doing what you want with your life, and just basically wasting a huge chunk of your life doing things that you were initially not really interested in at all, because, you know, they wouldn't have occurred to you except that those were the choices you were given. All of those things can be replaced with something, you know, a lot more, you know, sustaining, spiritually sustaining. For instance, you know, if instead of going through engineering school, as I did, I went through an apprenticeship and became a boat builder, for instance, I probably wouldn't have wasted so many years doing things I wasn't interested in before I got into boats. That's just a personal example, but everybody is really interested in something, and most of the time they don't get to do it because the economy doesn't require it, because there's no profit in it for whoever runs the economy. And so if the profit motive is destroyed in a collapse, it's sort of a reset, and people get to think about what they really want and how little they can get away with doing of the things that they don't want to do. And I think it's a much, much saner way to live in some ways.
Well, I was just at a car-free festival, you know, where they closed down the streets and people came out and celebrated just being alive. There were a lot of young people there. It gave me quite a bit of hope, and I thought, well, yeah, this is what the city really could be like without this oil-based economy. And there could be some new movements and a lot of involvement and a lot of community building ahead of us.
Absolutely. My whole life now is it's one big car-free festival. I've given up on cars. A few years ago, I just bicycle everywhere. I bicycle and I sail. You know, I bought a tank of gas for my sailboat. I have a little outboard to push it around in and out of the marina. I bought it a few months ago. I think it'll last me halfway through the summer. I think I might go through two gas tanks this year. So, you know, I'm a little bit fossil fuel dependent, but nothing like the people who drive back and forth all day.
We're chatting with Dmitry Orlov. He's the author of Reinventing Collapse, The Soviet Example and American Prospects, just out from New Society Publishers. He has a lot of friends like James Howard Kunstler, KMO, Rand Preer, Jan Lundberg, and Matt Savinar. And they're all listed as part of Club Orlov, and that's where you can tune into Dmitry's site on the web. Orlov is spelled O-R-L-O-V. His blog is cluborlov.blogspot.com. Well, I notice your publisher, Dmitry, is based in Canada, and I know you've just finished a lot of interviews with right-wing radio hosts in the United States. The right seems to own the AM talk show dial down there. Do you have trouble finding a publisher, and what's the main reaction from these radio jocks? Do they call you a commie, or do they resist it, or are they listening?
And as far as the publisher, it was really no problem finding the publisher. So, but as far as the radio thing, I think the thing that depresses me is, if anything, is that, you know, I've been able to reach many, many, many people, but none of them seem to read books. So they're sitting in their cars, they're listening to the radio, they may have, you know, laughed, cried, whatever, but none of them probably went and bought my book.
Well,
they don't read.
I'm going to disagree with you. I'll bet you find that some of them did. People sort of react with denial at first, but there are still a few book readers out there. And, well, it's good that you're on radio with us now, because for those who like to listen to their information, they're getting it straight from you. And I wanted to ask you, before we close off, is there something else that you'd really like to talk about, something that my questions haven't reached?
Well, I really want to stress something that, you know, very few people point out. There's this great division between the big picture. It's important to know what's going on in you know, in the big world, you know, to have the big picture, to have this realization that, you know, the mass media is really hiding the truth from us in a lot of ways, and you have to find your own truth, and it's fairly difficult. But once you do, you can form your own picture of what's going on in the world. And at the same time, it's very important to do practical things in your own life, and a lot of people have trouble making that transition. You know, a lot of people's lives lack the flexibility to make incremental changes. And I just want to say that it's easy and pleasant. Like, you know, I got rid of my car and you know, that was, you know, an abrupt transition, and I felt uncomfortable for a little while because I had a lot of habits that centered around the car, as we all do, that had to basically die away over a period of time. And, similar changes can be made, and they seem like wrenching changes, but in retrospect, they don't seem that wrenching. So I would encourage people to experiment with their lives. Don't just passively absorb the big picture and become depressed by it, or, you know, have some other reactions, but not really do anything about it. Because you can't do something about it. It's just that it doesn't concern the big world. It concerns you, the people you know, the relationships around you, and what you do.
Well, that's some really good advice. I know people do watch the screen or go on the net, and they get somewhat stunned by it all, and they're too busy trying to make a living to do anything. But I agree with you. I'm trying to make incremental changes. I've changed my diet. I'm heading towards vegetarianism, for example. And I think all of those things will eventually add up, and they certainly pay off for me with better health and lower costs. So I want to thank Dmitry Orlov for coming on Radio EcoShock. We've barely scratched the surface. Maybe we can have you back again in the fall, and I don't mean the fall of civilization. I mean next autumn, if you're willing.
Absolutely. It would be a pleasure.
This is James McMurdy.
There's a Vietnam vet with a cardboard sign sitting there by the left turn line. Flag on his wheelchair flapping in the breeze, one leg missing and both hands free. No one's paying much mind to him. The VA budget's just stretched so thin, and now there's more coming back from the Mideast war. We can't make it here anymore. And that big old building was a textile mill. It fed our kids and it paid our bills, but they turned us out and they closed the doors. We can't make it here anymore. You see those pallets piled up on the loading dock? They're just gonna sit there till they rot, 'cause there's nothing to ship, nothing to pack, just busted concrete and rusted tracks. Empty storefronts around the square, there's a needle in the gutter and glass everywhere. You don't come down here unless you're looking to score. We can't make it here anymore. The bar's still open, but man, it's slow. The tip jar's light and the register's low. The bartender don't have much to say. The regular crowd's getting thinner each day. Some have maxed out all their credit cards. Some are working two jobs and living in cars. Minimum wage won't pay for a roof. Won't pay for a drink if you gotta have proof. Try it yourself, Mr. CEO. See how far 5:15 an hour will go. Take a part-time job at one of your stores. I bet you can't make it here anymore. And there's a high school girl with a bourgeois dream, just like the pictures in the magazine she found on the floor of the laundromat. A woman with kids can forget all that. If she comes up pregnant, what'll she do? Forget the career, forget about school. Can she live on faith, live on hope, high on Jesus and hooked on dope? When it's way too late to just say no, you can't make it here anymore. Should I hate a people for the shade of their skin or the shape of their eyes? Yeah, right. Now I'm stocking shirts in the Walmart store, just like the ones we made before. Except this one came from Singapore. I guess we can't make it here anymore. Should I hate a people for the shade of their skin, or the shape of their eyes, or the shape I'm in? Should I hate them for having our jobs today? No, I hate the men sent the jobs away. I can see them all now, they haunt my dreams, all lily white and squeaky clean. They've never known want, they'll never know need. Their shit don't stink and their kids won't bleed. Their kids won't bleed in their damn little war, and we can't make it here anymore. We'll work for food, we'll die for oil, we'll kill for power, to us the spoils. The billionaires get to pay less tax, the working poor get to fall through the cracks. So let them eat jelly beans, let them eat cake, let them eat shit, whatever it takes. They can join the Air Force or join the Corps if they can't make it here anymore. So that's how it is, that's what we got, if the president wants to admit it or not. You can read it in the paper, read it on the wall, hear it on the wind if you're listening at all. Get out of that limo and look us in the eye, call us on a cell phone, tell us all why. In Dayton, Ohio, Portland, Maine, or a cotton gin out on the great high plains, it's done closed down, along with the school and the hospital and the swimming pool. And dust devils dance in the noonday heat, and there's rats in the alley and trash in the street. gang graffiti on a boxcar door. You can't make it here anymore.
Right, we've all come to recognize the extraordinary danger global warming presents, but there has long been a consensus about this danger. The consensus that we're doing it, as Al Gore describes it, the debate is over. There are 5 points in this consensus. Number one, global warming is real. Number two, we human beings are mainly responsible. Number three, the consequences are very bad. Number four, we need to fix it quickly. And number five, it's not too late. Now, they did a study to evaluate how well that consensus was actually adopted by people who know something about the matter. So they took a random sample of 1,000 articles in peer-reviewed journals between 1993 and 2003. And they discovered that 0%, exactly zero, questioned the basic assumptions. Then they did a comparable study of articles in popular media journals between 1988 and 2002, 600 articles. They found that 53% questioned the basic consensus. Now, that result is a product of the junk science that's been funded by the oil industry to make people think that 2 and 2 might be 5 under some circumstances. Who knows? We can't really tell. Leading to the extraordinary delay that our government has allowed, maybe 10 years before we address perhaps the most important public policy question our generations will face. Again, an easy question. Government just gets wrong.
That was the voice of Lawrence Lessig, professor at the Stanford Law School, speaking at the Minneapolis National Conference for Media Reform on June 7, 2008. We already know that just 5 corporations dominate almost all American media. And that machine has followed the administration lead not just to war of occupation in Iraq, but down the path to climate hell brought on by continued carbon consumerism. But there is an alternative, and you are listening to part of it. Community stations, college stations, low-power FM stations, thousands of them and growing. Blogs by the millions, the whole net downloading. You can get 2 whole hours of recordings from the Media Reform Conference from a busy website called radioforall.net. The founder of that nonprofit radio exchange site is Lynn Gary, a longtime media activist, now in upstate New York. Her underground program, Unwelcome Guests, goes out to 21 stations. Look for Unwelcome Guests program number 415 at radioforall.net. That's radio, the number 4, all.net, for the rowdy alternative talk that you need to hear about media reform. Why big media doesn't make it here anymore. Newspaper readers and advertisers are wandering away, and big networks are feeling the heat. The New York Times finally had to let their top climate reporter, Andrew Revkin, off the Republican leash to host his own blog. Check it out at .earth.blogs.nytimes.com. Andy is worth your time. That's Andrew Revkin. Discover Channel has a new show called Planet Green. It's a little watered down, but means well and heads in the right direction. That's at planetgreen.discovery.com. But the real shocker, ABC News, the Disney Corporation arm, is promoting a new program this September called Earth 2100. You can contribute to the program yourself by sending in video ideas like the ones we ran at the start of this program. You can even game the end of civilization as we know it at Earth2100.tv. The ABC News website asks, are we living in the last century of our civilization? Is it possible that all of our technology, knowledge, and wealth cannot save us from ourselves? Could our society actually be heading towards collapse? Hey, 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 stop it now. That's my job. It's getting so crowded here at the edge. But don't worry. The oil industry continues to fight back, and they have the bucks to buy anybody. Earlier in the show, we heard the ABC meteorologist settle down Peter Jennings' concerns that maybe, well just maybe, all the fires in Florida and California, the once-in-500-years never-before-seen flooding in the Midwest, might be climate change. At the Grist.com Grist Mill, guest blogger Brad Johnson suggested American weather woes might be related to America's failure to rein in greenhouse gases. He was slugged by an official-sounding response from Ralph, who explained, "Brad, you're a tool. The fact of the matter is the planet has cooled, and there is a massive amount of cold air spilling southward this spring. It has nothing whatsoever to do with global warming," end quote. Who are these never-ending idiots who pop up whenever sanity suggests itself? I looked up Ralph, found Ralph Hansen, Ph.D., ran that through Google. Over at the denier site, Newsbusters, Hansen describes himself as, quote, "amateur meteorologist, recovering journalist turned economist, gainfully employed in the energy industry." Not a climate scientist, he proudly works in the energy industry. Ralph gets his paycheck from the fossil fuels. Well, what a surprise. Think about all the phony war experts in the media secretly paid by the Pentagon. Now, don't you think the oil and coal men have enough money to pay out bloggers and 1,000 Ralphs to load up the comments section of every questioning blog? Whenever a mere climate scientist claims we only have a few years left to act, or some citizen calls for real change, look out for a deluge of boos and catcalls, not to mention junk science. If you measured the responses, even in left-leaning blogs and websites, you would think Americans are heavily opposed to the idea of climate change and hate the idea of saving the planet. Funny, real polls of real people show just the opposite. Most of us care a lot and want the climate to be stabilized, so it's not just the mainstream media that is skewed by corporate ownership. Even the web is constantly poisoned by these cranks and corporate skunks who want you to keep slurping up oil in your sleep. I feel sorry for the kids trying to feel their way around this poison, and for their parents, the burned out, flooded out, and kicked out. Those people are going to get heard. They are going to get their day. I'm Alex Smith, and this is the Radio EcoShock Show. Find us on the web at ecoshock.org. Let's go to an interview with Anthony Marr. Folks, sometimes I get sick of hearing how climate change is going to impact people in the cities or the rich real estate on the coast. It's all about humans this and humans that. Meanwhile, our fellow creatures, the marvelous animals of this world, are struggling with unnatural changes. The seasonal clock is out of adjustment. Sea currents are too warm, or winds and rain have changed. It is sad to say, countless animals are close to extinction. Experts predict millions of species will just die off because of climate change that we humans have caused. Now, these animals cannot speak. They have no Facebook pages. But Anthony Marr of Vancouver is one of those humans who feel their plight and speaks for the animals. Anthony is founder of Heal Our Planet Earth and a longtime animal rights activist and a frequent guest on the Animal Voices radio show. Anthony, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex.
Well, the human rights movement is, I actually mean to say the animal rights movement is growing a lot lately, but do you think that the animal rights movement is really tuned in to climate change?
Well, if you consider me as an integral part of the animal rights movement, yes, it is, because I am myself tuned into it. But I have to be honest and say that I'm in this very small minority in the animal rights movement who have been plugged into the climate change situation, except for one factor, which is animal agriculture, which produces a lot of, emits a lot of methane into the atmosphere, and methane is a very powerful greenhouse gas compared to carbon dioxide, maybe 20 to 75 times as powerful. So the first thing to note is that the meat industry is a huge cause of global warming. So that having been said, global warming impacts on a huge amount of species all around the globe with specific emphasis on certain areas. And of particular concern to me and huge concern actually worldwide is the Amazon rainforest. The Amazon, other than being the lungs of the earth, it is also the contains, I would say, between one third to one half of the world's species. So, considering that a generally accepted figure for the total number of species on the earth today, that's known species today, is approximately 20 million species. So, we're talking about between, say, 7 to 10 million species in the Amazon rainforest. And the Amazon rainforest as a whole is set to follow the rather tragic course of becoming a savanna or even a desert within a century because of global warming and climate change. And a prelude has already played out in 2005, which has been predicted in 2004. And those people who predicted the disaster, which is a huge drought in the Amazon, were booed as, you know, sort of alarmists and doomsday prophets, but it played out. 2004, they said that there would be a drought. 2005, a huge drought came down and wiped out lots and lots of sub-ecosystems.
Yeah, that was incredible. I remember seeing photographs of these riverbanks that were just sort of like half a mile of dried out mud where the river should have been, right there in the rainforest. So that was an incredible change. Well, I think these things have to go both ways. I mean, there are millions of people worried about the future of their grandchildren in this strange new climate. But some of them think animal rights is just a dangerous fringe group. But as you say, many of the solutions to global warming come from a new respect for animals. Can you talk further about how protecting the animals might really protect our own future?
Well, if we protect the animals, we have to always, and I say always, protect the habitat. I'm talking about wild animals, of course. We definitely have to talk about the domestic animals to great length. But we're talking about wild animals here, and when we protect wild animals, for example, the tiger, which I specialize in, the Bengal tiger in India, we definitely have to... Well, the first order of business is not poaching, really. It is protection of habitat. And if we can protect the habitat, we hopefully can protect that part of the world from the general devastation of global warming. For example, in the Amazon rainforest, the global warming certainly would dry out the Amazon in the long run. However, active deforestation by logging, by slash-and-burn agriculture, by cattle ranching needing more land, by the latest is soy and sugar cane cultivation for producing ethanol as fuel, and both the beef and the ethanol produced in Brazil are consumed in North America. So we are very much driving the destruction of the Amazon rainforest by our use of ethanol in gas and by our consumption of beef. Huge consumption of beef. So political corruption has really got to be crashed down on. For example, George W. Bush and and Lula of Brazil, the ex-president, I think the current president actually, struck a deal that, you Brazil provide us with beef and with ethanol and we will support your industry, which means we will support your deforestation. And we consume the products, and the environmental damage is caused by us ultimately. So we must change our ways. Otherwise, we're going to destroy the far corners of the earth, and sooner or later, it's going to come back to us.
Well, you know, if George Bush is involved in a deal, it's going to be a good one. Ha ha. Well, are you making some progress with the animal rights people? I mean, are they just willing to throw up a minor web page on this, or do they realize that climate change is probably the biggest threat to the animals that we've seen in millions of years?
Well, I have been actively promoting climate change and global warming to the animal rights movement since I am deeply rooted in that movement, and I have been sending out a lot of material, emails, mass emails, blogs, and so on, and I've constructed a global warming section in my website, which is hope-care.org, hope-care.org, global warming section. And because of my promotion, I got, I believe my website got about 150,000 hits over the last several weeks. So that was that most of them would be from the animal rights movement. So I think that the animal rights movement is becoming aware of what I am concerned about.
Well, that is a lot of interest. Were you saying that the meat eater actually is more of a threat to the planet than the SUV driver if you added up all the carbon involved?
Yes. Well, carbon dioxide is a product of combustion, whereas methane is a product of animal agriculture. And as I mentioned before, methane is far, far more powerful as a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. So, and methane, by the way, is also being released from the permafrost, which is melting. And once that happens, it could really drive a runaway global heating cycle into a spiral. And I think we're in the beginning little bit of that spiral. And I have issued the heretical statement saying that runaway global heating has in fact begun because the permafrost has started to melt already and methane is being released. So between that methane and the animal agriculture, methane We are really in huge danger. I think methane is the most dangerous substance on Earth today, and far more than, so than all the weapons added up together, including nuclear weapons, and more inevitable. And the animal agriculture certainly contributes hugely to that. It is said that the amount of global heating generated by animal agriculture is about 20 to 25% higher than the heat generated by emissions from the transportation system.
So we can all really play a part in this. I've stopped eating red meat, period. I just won't eat it. I don't think it's safe, for one thing, the way the factory farming is working, but also I do care about the animals, and now I realize that they have to use a huge amount of grain that could be feeding other people who are going hungry in this world. What is it, about a ratio of 8 to 1 for the amount of grain, 8 times as much grain to feed 1 pound of beef?
It's 8 to 20, actually.
Is it 8 to 20 that high? Wow. So that's not that hard a change to make. What do you tell people around you? They realize that the climate's a big threat. They are concerned about the animals. How do they get started?
Well, first of all, change personal habits and way of life. Change personal habits and the way of life of the entire society is what's really needed globally. And the way of life, of course, is, you know, make some personal sacrifices, use less energy, cut down on meat and cut out meat eventually if you haven't yet. And drive a more energy-efficient car, take public transit whenever possible. But absolutely the most important thing that everybody should do is to support anti-global warming activists in defeating global warming and saving massive amounts of species. For example, if the Amazon rainforest becomes a desert, you know, we're going to lose between 7 to 10 million species. And it is also said that if the global average temperature rises by 6 degrees, which is predicted very heavily, we're going to lose about 85% of all the species on Earth, and that is by the year 2100. So we must participate and at least support these major projects to tackle these huge problems, not just personal habits. So that is would require huge societal changes, anything from infrastructure, changing from oil burning to renewable resources, not meaning ethanol, of course. I'm talking about solar, wind, geothermal, wave, tidal, and all these do not emit anything. It is also said that if just the country of Angola alone in Africa, if they develop solar energy to a certain extent, they can provide for the energy needs of the entire Europe. So, and also a much smaller piece of real estate in Alberta developed into dedicated to solar energy can provide for the entire Canada. And the Alberta tar sands is absolutely the worst thing that is happening today, and it must be defeated, and my own target. And I vow to the world that I'm going to put the tar sands into permanent hibernation within 3 years, and everybody says it is impossible. Well, it could be impossible, but it is necessary. So it is, we must do whatever is necessary, not whatever is possible. And whatever is necessary sometimes very often becomes possible. So when you put enough heart and desperation into it, it will happen. And one of the major thrusts in my campaign is to shut down the Alberta tar sands within 3 years. And I'm taking the campaign to the United States as well as to the world within 3 years. And I'm on the point of launching a 4-month road tour to the U.S. North and northeastern states to push for support to shut down the Alberta tar sands. And I think there's a lot of support in the world and growing rapidly. Like in today's Vancouver Sun, there is this article in the section of BC Business that the Alberta tar sands is getting a very, very poor reputation, that the world is rising up against it. And I'll be in the tar sands in the first couple of days in July to actually take some samples, water samples, soil samples, because the native Chippewa people are suffering hugely high rates of very exotic forms of cancer never seen before. And it is definitely tied to the pollution generated by the tar sands, which cannot possibly pass any environmental assessment. And we're going to challenge them on that.
Plus, that's one of the big reasons Canada can't hope to meet its Kyoto targets. And we're selling all the oil off to the Americans. It's the dirtiest source of oil anybody can imagine.
Exactly.
It's definitely got to shut down if we want to keep the same planet that we've got. Well, my thanks to you, Anthony Marr, for joining us today. Could you give us our website again today?
It is at www.hope-care.org. HOPE stands for Heal Our Planet Earth, which is my organization. And I would like to make one last comment. That is, BC We are talking about the Alberta tar sands, but BC is very much complicit in that because of this very long pipeline leading right through BC, across BC from Alberta tar sands to Kitimat. And that pipeline must be shut down because if there is a pipeline, there will be tankers in BC waters. And there is a lot of action against that as well. So I hope to form some kind of a coalition to fight the tar sands.
Well, this is Radio EcoShock, and I encourage people who are interested in animal rights to visit Anthony Marr's site and also to get with us on fighting climate change while we still have a climate that can support the animals, and we do love the animals here. So thanks again, Anthony Marr.
Thank you, Alex.
The International Energy Agency says carbon emissions will go up 130% by 2050 unless governments make major changes. This is planet-killing time, the doubling of greenhouse gases. The IEA is calling for a massive investment to convert away from carbon fuels. The Stockholm Network report, Carbon Scenarios, says that even if all the existing climate agreements and announced government plans were really implemented, the temperature will still rise over 3 degrees centigrade this century. That means the permafrost will melt, releasing wild amounts of CO2 and methane. Dr. Paul Domjan, basing the report on studies done at the UK's Hadley Centre, told the Sunday Observer, the 2-degree target is impossible and a 3-degree target is implausible. That was June 8th. On the peak oil front, a vice president from Shell Oil has admitted we might be there already. Here's the clip.
The rising price of crude since the beginning of the year was one of the hottest topics at the Asia Oil and Gas Conference, which has just wrapped up in Malaysia. Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, now has oil production reached its peak. And how will this affect demand? Some really good questions. Well, Sri Jagaraja of CNBC put those questions to Greg Hill, Executive Vice President, Asia Pacific at Shell Exploration and Production. And this is what he had to say.
First of all, I think we believe at Shell that conventional easy oil and gas is probably nearing its peak. So if I think about conventional things, I think the peak is emerging. Having said that, there's still an awful lot of hydrocarbons to play for. But those hydrocarbons, of course, are in deeper water. They may be under ice. They may be in places with very difficult host governments. Or they might be trapped in difficult rocks like oil shale or oil sands.
Of course, to keep the water muddy, another Shell official chimed in with the head of BP saying there is plenty of oil. We just have to wreck the Arctic, the Rocky Mountains, and the deep sea to get at it. American TV is full of advertising, supposedly from the energy workers, saying the world will need 45% more oil and gas by 2030. Are they asleep? Are they dead? We can't possibly increase fossil fuels and survive. Burn, baby, burn. But hey, we have nuclear power to save us. Unless, of course, we listen to longtime alternative energy expert Amory Lovins. Lovins is testifying to Congress at the Select Committee on Energy Independence and Global Warming on March 12, 2008. Google that committee to find lots of good video testimony.
Find all the links mentioned in today's program in our weekly show blog. That's at ecoshock.org/podcast.
Our final witness is Mr. Amory Lovins, who is chairman and chief scientist of the Rocky Mountain Institute and chairman emeritus of Fiberforge Incorporated. Mr. Lovins has published 29 books and hundreds of papers and advises governments and major firms worldwide on advanced energy and resource efficiency. We are honored to have you with us here today. Mr. Lovins, whenever you are ready, please begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, distinguished committee members. I appreciate this opportunity to share with the committee some recent analysis of whether we need nuclear power, especially to protect the climate. I'll summarize why nuclear power is not needed for any civilian purpose, how and why it's being dramatically outcompeted in the global marketplace by no-carbon and low-carbon electrical resources that deliver far more climate solution per dollar, far faster, and why nuclear expansion would inhibit climate protection, energy security, and reliably powering prosperity. Even if nuclear power could attract private risk capital, it could not, in principle, deliver its claimed climate and security benefits. But because it's uneconomic and unnecessary, we needn't inquire into its other attributes. Far from undergoing a renaissance, nuclear power is conspicuously failing in the marketplace for the same forgotten reason it failed previously. It costs too much, and it bears too much financial risk to attract private risk capital, despite federal subsidies now approaching or exceeding its total cost. What is beating nuclear power and other central thermal plants? Micropower, that is, cogeneration plus distributed renewables, now produces a sixth of the world's total electricity, more than nuclear, at least a third of the world's new electricity, and from a sixth to over half of all electricity in a dozen industrial countries. The U.S. lags with about 4%. Negawatts, electricity saved by using it more efficiently or timely, are about as big worldwide as micropower and cost even less. In 2006, nuclear power added less capacity than photovoltaics added, one-tenth what wind power added, and 30 to 41 times less than micropower added. Its output growth was one-sixth of micropower's. Distributed renewables won $56 billion of private risk capital. Nuclear, as usual, got zero. Only central planners buy it. China's distributed renewable capacity reached seven times its nuclear capacity and are growing seven times faster. Micropower has such huge potential that just the full economic use of electric efficiency, zero-carbon waste heat cogeneration, and wind power, with no other renewables, could provide roughly 13 to 15 times nuclear power's current share of U.S. electric generation without significant land use, reliability, or other constraints at much lower cost and with millions of good new jobs. Distributed generators are generally more dependable than centralized ones because their many small units won't all fail at once and can bypass the grid where nearly all power failures originate. Variable renewable resources, sun and wind, even in large amounts, need less backup than we've already bought and built to manage the intermittence of big thermal plants, especially nuclear plants, many of which can fail simultaneously, unpredictably, and for long periods. The Nuclear Energy Institute says 78% of the new coal plants announced in the past couple of years got canceled. I expect announced nuclear projects to do worse because they cost more. They've attracted no private risk capital, despite U.S. taxpayer subsidies that can now total about $13 billion per new nuclear plant, roughly its entire cost, which exceeds the market cap of any U.S. utility save one. The smart money led by Warren Buffett is now heading for the exit, spooked by steeply rising nuclear costs, disappointments in the flagship Finnish project, competition by ever-cheaper micropower negawatts, and the credit crunch. The U.S. can have only about as many new nuclear plants as taxpayers are forced to buy. Heroic efforts at near or over 100% subsidization will continue to elicit the same response as defibrillating a corpse. It will jump, but it won't revive. But that's good for climate protection, because nuclear power is so expensive that it buys roughly 1.5 to 11 or more times less carbon reduction per dollar than competing no-carbon technologies or even fossil-fueled cogeneration in factories and buildings. As the graph in my pre-filed testimonies Annex E explains, or the graphs explain, I should say, nuclear plants cost so much more than competing climate solutions that spending a dollar on nuclear instead of on efficient end use worsens global warming more than spending the same dollar on new coal power. It's therefore time to get on with judicious investments that yield the most energy services and the most climate protection per dollar and per year. The straightest path to American energy security and to a richer, fairer, cooler, and safer world is to let all ways to save or produce energy compete fairly at honest prices, regardless of their type, technology, size, location, and ownership. That's pretty much the opposite of the federal energy policy we have. Thank you, sir.
That was Amory Lovins of the Rocky Mountain Institute testifying before Congress. Find out more about Amory Lovins at rmi.org. Next week on Radio EcoShock, we'll listen to a presentation by Australia's preeminent climate advisor, Ross Garnaut. Australia has been hard hit by a climate-driven drought as their rains went south towards the pole, just as our rains will in North America. The people voted for action through the new Prime Minister, Kevin Rudd. I think the next American president will look to Australia and Ross Garneau, so you're going to hear what pops up in this speech in plenty of places around the world. But watch out. There is a big black hole in the Green Revolution down under. Next week on Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Good for you for hanging in when the going gets tough. The tough get going.